everyone, welcome to our event. This event is brought to you by Datadogs Club, which is a community of people who love data. We have weekly events. Today is one of such events. If you want to find out more about the events we have, there is a link in the description. Go there, click on that link, and you'll see many events we have in our pipeline. Actually, right now, there are quite a few of them, so go check it out. Then do not forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. This way, you will get notifications about future streams like the stream we have today. And we have an amazing Slack community where you can hang out with other data enthusiasts. This week, we will talk about building machine learning products and teams. We will see where it goes. But initially, originally, the topic was that, but we changed the questions a little bit in the meantime. But we have a very special guest today, Reem. Reem is the director of data science at Interview AI. Do I pronounce it correctly? Interview?
Yeah.
Interview yeah. AI. Which is an HR tech startup. She has a lot of experience in training and mentoring people in the data space. She also co-founded an AI education company and upskilled more than 3,000 people. In total, she has over 8 years of experience in the data space, and she also has a PhD, and you researched transfer learning, right?
Yeah, so. Machine learning from limited data.
Yeah, exactly.
Transfer learning was essentially where that led. But yeah.
So yeah, welcome to the interview, to our event.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Like I said, a huge fan of what you guys do. So I was very happy to get the chance to be here and contribute back in some way.
Yeah, thank you for being here. And yeah, the questions for today's interview are prepared by Johanna Bayer and also Reem. But thanks, Johanna, for your help, as always.
Thank you.
And yeah, before we go into our main topic of building machine learning teams, let's start with your background. Can you tell us about your career journey so far?
Yes. So I originally started my career in my bachelor's studies, as most people. And there I was actually an electrical engineer. So I was fascinated with physics. I was a huge nerd when it came to electromagnetics. And that was something I was very passionate about. Led me into electrical engineering. And so it was a bit, you know, not too far, but a bit of a different field than where I am today. But there was still an intersection with software engineering, computer engineering in general. But it was in my last year where I took accidentally my first course in AI. And that was my first exposure to the topic. And I got fascinated. I was someone who was always curious about how things are built. And so when I came across this idea that we can get machines to do things in a smart way, that was fascinating for me because I was only familiar with, you know, traditional software and explicitly giving machines instructions on how to do things. So this idea of being able to do more than that was very cool for myself back then. So I decided that I wanted to pursue like a master's degree specializing in this area, purely out of just, you know, being more curious. And back then, it wasn't that long ago, but back then, 2015, it was kind of like an obvious choice to go for graduate school. I think today you have a lot more options on how you can dive into the field. So that's what I did. I went into graduate school, really enjoyed the research that I did. So, you know, extended it into the PhD as well and continued working in the field. During my PhD, that's when I co-founded the startup on AI education. So I started kind of like balancing between, you know, my academic work as well as kind of the startup world and how things worked there. Got fascinated with startups, finished my PhD, joined another startup where I'm currently, you know, building the HR tech solution that you mentioned. And yeah, this is where I'm at today.
Well, must be not easy to simultaneously start in a startup and then doing your PhD, right?
No, yeah, it was not easy, but it was a lot of fun actually because it was a nice balance because during the PhD, you know, a PhD is very intense and you get to do a lot of work. I mean, for those who have been in a similar journey, you get to do a lot of very intense work and mostly to some extent alone. And I balanced that out with, you know, the excitement of working with a team and training people and kind of that community aspect because everything that we also did in that company was very much community driven. So it was kind of like a balancing act. As long as you're enjoying what you're doing, then you end up managing somehow like that.
Yeah. So you said that your research was, you had your first course in AI last year of your bachelor studies. you really liked it and you enrolled in the master program. You also liked it. So then you continued researching in, during your PhD, and your research was about transfer learning with limited data, right? Yeah. Can you tell us a bit more? What did you?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, that was a very long time ago, but I hope I can remember like how things came together. So during my master's, I mean, my advisor was already working on certain areas, and he was specifically focused on natural language processing and context-aware sensing. And back then, NLP was still not the hype that it is today. So it was more of basic or more foundational NLP stuff, I would say, not basic, but more foundational. I was fascinated with the context-aware sensing because the applications that he was working on were very much touching people's lives. And for me, like...
Context-aware sensing, you said?
Context-aware sensing. So...
Context-aware sensing, yeah.
Yeah, what, like what wearable devices for like human activity recognition, emotion recognition, sensing human behavior and environment, stuff like that, right? So he was working on a variety of these things. So I started kind of looking down this direction. I didn't end up down that path, but along the way, I came across the idea of transfer learning and multitask learning and this concept of getting models to learn from each other. Again, you know, I was starting in the field back then. So for me, driven by the same curiosity, I was like, wow, like, okay, that's interesting. Not only can you teach a machine, but you can get them to kind of learn from each other's experiences. That sounds very cool. So that's when I got into, you know, diving into multitask learning, specifically a branch of transfer learning, where you're able to learn multiple tasks, multiple problems that you're trying to basically optimize the model for using one model, essentially. So saving on resources. If your data sets are limited, you're able to kind of share and leverage knowledge across the tasks to boost the performance and stuff like that. And that was the focus in my master's, extended into my PhD and kind of branched out a bit more where I started looking into teacher models and if you want more kind of overarching challenges in multitask learning, transfer learning, like the challenges of catastrophic learning, where, you know, when you fine tune a model, you forget the old task. Are you able to maintain tasks as you fine tune models, even though their data is missing, and kind of, you know, diving into these things in more detail, but all within the realm or the umbrella of leveraging trained models to boost performance on other tasks and new tasks that suffer from limited data, whether naturally some tasks naturally suffer from limited data, or whether, you know, your initial stages of training and you don't have access to this data.
It's the first time I hear the term catastrophic learning. That's interesting. Yeah, I know the term, not the term, but like concept.
The concept.
Like, yeah, because it happened like when you set learning rate too high, the model just override accidentally the weights. Like, I don't know if you take this ImageNet model accidentally.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, it just forgets it.
Or even if you fine tune it on a smaller data set, it's still going to, it's going to become optimized for the new one and not really be able to perform the same on the old task. It's very, very interesting problems. Again, they're research driven. So they were very kind of like detailed problems, but it was an interesting space. And I kind of, this is the direction that I took.
Mm-hmm. And how do you switch your focus more towards the industry? Like you were doing your PhD and then you probably wanted to have something more practical, or how did it happen?
Yeah. Yes, actually. So even though I enjoyed the research that I was doing and the work that I was doing, I wasn't very much driven by the way that academia worked and kind of like the reward that you would get out of this heavy, heavy effort that you would put in. And I really wanted to be in a place where, you know, I was able to build something that would actually make it into practice and I would actually be able to see the impact and, you know, touch people's lives, basically, because most of the research that you do today doesn't end up making it to industry because of many, many factors. So that was something actually I early on kind of decided that I would be switching to industry once I'm done with my PhD. And so, yeah, it was driven from that, being able to kind of make a direct impact with a solution that people can actually use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess like touching people's lives with PhD research is way more difficult because in industry, like the loop between like you do something and then it affects people is way shorter, right? Compared to
Yes. And then again, most research doesn't make it to industry, right? I mean, we see on the industry side, you don't see it that way because you do see, you know, these foundational models that come up from R&D team. but they are really kind of centralized in these, you know, big tech companies. Everyone else in the world who's doing research, most of the time, you know, they're contributing to the body of work that's out there, yes, but it's not making it to production. And one of the main reasons actually is when you do research and you're optimizing models or you're improving, you're not really doing it with industry standards in mind. So many of the methods that are out there are probably not practical to make it into production, probably not needed, especially, you know, with companies that are still in early stages. I mean, at least where I am, I know that getting to a point where you have R&D grade models in production is not really, it's not really needed in most of the companies in the region where I am. People are still in very early stages kind of discovering how AI can help bring value to their organization.
And did you immediately start with a startup, or was there something else? Like, how did you transition a goal? What did you do?
I did. I immediately started with a startup. Actually, I started before I finished my PhD by a few months. It was, it was a coincidence, really. Like, I got approached by founders with the idea.
So you accidentally started the startup.
Not really. I mean, I'm not a founder of the startup, but I was approached by the founders who I'm sure did not accidentally begin their startup, but they were still at initial stages of kind of like, you know, thinking it out. And they wanted to brainstorm, you know, feasibility and all that stuff. And through the conversation, we got to a point where I was like, yeah, finishing my PhD. And they're like, oh, like, would you be interested to join? And I was. I mean, it was a very interesting product that they had in mind. It was something I knew would be very challenging and interesting to work on. And the impact for me was very meaningful. So I was like, okay, here we go. That's what I'll be doing after I'm done.
Was it a difficult transition?
Not really. I know a lot of people kind of, you know, think that the transition from PhD to industry is challenging. I think the one area that it's challenging in is the perception on the opposite side. I think people in industry look at you as a PhD candidate and they have certain assumptions that are difficult for you to kind of navigate. Depending, of course, on who you're talking with, but I've seen this a lot. Like, people assume, you know, you're going to be driven by, you know, whatever you were doing in research, and you're going to be very detail oriented, and you're not going to be able to adapt to, you know, industry standards and industry requirements.
Prejudices.
Yes, exactly. And that's your, you know, you're going to be stuck with your academic mindset. And, you know, obviously some people think you're overqualified and they don't consider you, et cetera, these challenges.
It's not like you're going to stuck with your academic mindset. It's what people think you're going to do. Right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. And then there's also like this thing that I faced, and I know many people who face, which is like, you know, you leave your PhD and there's also this challenge of, you know, in industry, your experience is counted in years of work in other companies. Yeah. So for them, it's a bit weird to kind of process, but you've been in school for the past X years. So do you have work experience? I've been there. And I was like, right? And it's hard to explain it, honestly. Like, I've been in situations where it was hard to explain, like, I have the experience. I mean, I might not have the experience that you have structured in your mind. I gained it elsewhere and in different ways. So it's hard to kind of communicate that to the opposite side. But the transition, at least for me personally, it wasn't that difficult, especially maybe that I had already gotten exposed to industry. So I was already, you know, consulting on projects. It wasn't something entirely new for me working on, you know, industry projects. And so I knew that, you know, the mindset would have to be different. You're not coming in to try and build complex models that are like 1-2% outperforming state of the art or so on and so forth, right? I mean, as long as you have the right expectations in mind and you do this transition, it shouldn't be difficult. And in many cases, actually, there are industry roles specifically tailored for PhD graduates. In my case, it wasn't. I wasn't working in a role that would require, let's say, a PhD, but there are many roles that would require that, in which case, you don't really need to transition from your mindset.
So maybe let's talk a bit in more detail about what you were doing for this HR tech companies. So as I understood, the first, it was a startup, not the one you co-founded, but a startup. I don't know, was it an HR tech too?
So the first startup was a training. It was an education startup. That was my startup that I co-founded with a group of friends. Yeah. And that I worked on during my PhD. But the one I'm in right now, I joined after I finished my PhD, and I was like one of the initial team members. I'm not a founder, but I was one of the people who kind of initiated the whole thing. And yes, it's an HR tech startup. So we're building an AI.
HR tech in general.
I mean, in a nutshell, any technological solution that's serving the HR space, right?
Which is like hiring or upskilling people or?
Both. So whether you're talking about, so usually in HR, you can talk about hiring, right? Which involves actually many, many things. So screening and then the different interviewing phases that could be involved, managing, like, you know, what ATSs probably do today. And then you can talk about employee, kind of like employee retention, employee assessment, right? And training as well. So this is all within HR. In my case, we're focusing specifically on recruitment. So the initial stages of people coming in and more specifically on the screening phase. So yeah.
So this is the company where you work at right now, right?
Yeah.
So what do you do?
So we're building an AI video interviewing solution.
That's cool.
It is. It's very cool. Of course, I'm biased, but I mean, the idea or the motivation behind what we're doing is, I think we'd all agree, CVs are not really the best way to present yourself. And so the motivation is to kind of give you a chance, give everyone a chance to present themselves through a richer medium than just their CV. Usually in the screening process, you know, you submit your CV wherever you submit it. The ADS system would do some keyword matching and, you know, decide if you match the requirements or not. Many flaws there, right, on many different levels. We want to kind of change that and allow you to start with an interview and your CV. I mean, we're not going to get rid of your CV. You still need to know what you've done, or the recruiter still needs to know what you've done, but to allow you to interview. So it's kind of like you're getting directly to the first HR interview where you usually would not get this chance. And we assess you basically on behavioral traits. So we're not looking to assess you on, you know, like your technical capacity. That would happen in later stages beyond screening. But the point is to kind of give you a chance to present yourself and your qualifications as an individual. So behavioral aspect, like soft skills, right?
Is it the interview with an actual human or with an AI?
No, it's with an AI. So it's an avatar that interviews you.
Okay.
She actually has a name. Her name is Ina at the moment. We're going to have more interviewers in the future. But you get interviewed by an avatar. So the entire process is automated. It's cool because you get to do the interview really at any time that suits you, anywhere that you'd like, your phone, your laptop, etc. It's like a 15-20 minute interview. And you get the chance to really give more than just your CV, right? And then in the background, your recruiter is able to look at your CV as well as, you know, your richer representation, if you will, of what you can bring to the table as an individual.
So then it's also, I guess, recorded. So then the recruiter can look at the interview itself. Probably there is a summary, right, at the end of the interview that they can look at.
There's a whole assessment. You're getting interviewed by an AI, you get assessed by an AI, but the assessment, the point of the AI assessment that happens in the background is to rank the candidates based on their performance in terms of your level of soft skill, right? So in the background, the recruiter has an open position, whatever that position may be, let's say it's for a software engineer, and they would define the required level of soft skills that they believe is necessary for the role. And so you perform the interview, and then your performance on those soft skills is compared and benchmarked against the requirements, and you get ranked. So the recruiter at the end of the day gets a ranked list of candidates. We don't tell them, you know, you should hire this person. The decision is up to them. But they get an easier, if you want, filtration where they can start with the best fit candidates in terms of behavioral qualifications and check their CVs, see if they make it through, you know, the requirements, and they get into the system for the next stage of the interview. So this is essentially how it works.
Mm-hmm. And what do candidates think about being interviewed by an avatar?
Mixed feelings. I've seen mixed feelings, actually. And one interesting pattern I noticed is that it seems younger generations really enjoy it, which I find weird. Like, I get it if you're neutral, but they really enjoy it. I even had candidates who would tell me they were more comfortable interviewing with the avatar than an actual person, because the avatar was not judging them with facial expressions. I was like, you've probably had bad interviews in the past. I don't know what kind of recruiter was judging you straight on. But yeah, I've had mixed feelings. So you see IT candidates who are excited, right, about this innovation and this new way of doing things. Candidates who are obviously like uncomfortable. Oh, like, I'm not comfortable talking to the screen. And then candidates who refuse the process altogether. Candidates who are not comfortable getting recorded and their data, you know, being stored or being used for training or whatever, you know, their reasons that they may have.
It's like, I was wondering, maybe there are cases when people think it disrespectful that instead of a human, an actual human being, there is
a robot. That's interesting.
Can't you just find time for me? Like, why there is a robot?
That's a good point, but I would get that as a candidate, right? Because you're kind of, maybe for me, it's kind of like, I would motivate it from the perspective of, this is not even an interview you would get, right? It's not like we're replacing, you know, the recruiter's interview or, you know, the interviews that come into the process. We're giving you an extra opportunity where, you know, showcase yourself better. You can think about it in a way, it's kind of like we present ourselves on LinkedIn as well, right? So you have, you know, your LinkedIn profile, which is an additional representation to your CV. And now this is kind of an additional step. You can present yourself as naturally as possible and have that taken into consideration where, what was the other option? You're going to upload your CV and some ATS is going to screen you for keywords and probably not hear back from the recruiter for a while. So again, that's my perspective. I'm on the inside, but that's interesting. I will see how we can translate that into the solution so no one feels disrespected. That's a good point, actually. I've never crossed my mind.
Because, like, I imagine this is a replacement for, like, when I apply for a job, there could be a questionnaire that I need to fill in, right?
Yeah.
And then this
exactly.
Kind of replacement, but more interactive. And then instead like thinking and typing, and then that might take even more time, actually, than just having a 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I guess the time is like at when it's convenient for me as a candidate. It's not like, okay, you need to show up at 3 p.m. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like
you have a timeline, and then you can take it whenever you want. Exactly.
Yeah.
So we try to make it as convenient as possible. And this is actually what I do. So when I recruit for my position, this is your application process, you know, upload your CV and take the interview. And this is where the screening would start. I mean, we can talk about this a bit more, but I've had many cases where I really felt like if I had looked at your CV, I would not have picked you out of the screening, but it was because of the interview and because of the way I saw that you presented yourself that I was interested in you. And I thought, you know, this candidate looks like they have promise and I would like to interview them further. So I've been there personally and I kind of see the value that, you know, can be brought to the table out of this experience.
It's like a CV is a soulless thing, like just a piece of paper, not even piece of paper, like this one or two PDF pages, right? And then like you don't always remember that there is a human, but like when it's like that, when it's recorded, when you can see what kind of person it is, right? Maybe it gives.
Yeah, exactly. And like they provide richer responses.
Yeah.
Yeah. They provide rich responses. They give you examples from their work experience and you get to know them. You get to know them a bit better. The CV, I mean, also a lot of us are not very good actually at making our CVs. It's probably better these days because you get all these tools that kind of help you. Still, most of us are not good at designing our CVs. So it's really not a good representation of you, even in that single page.
Well, I imagine in this company, you have a lot of ML products there. And then since we talk about building ML products today.
Yeah.
We have a lot of questions, but there is a question from Peter, which maybe is a summary of all the questions we have. So the question is, can we have an overview of the journey of a machine learning project from the beginning to the end and how to track value from the product? So I guess this is like a quite an extensive question, right? Which covers pretty much everything we want to cover.
Especially the last part. That's a good one, actually.
If we talk about an overview from the beginning to the end, like maybe you have a sequence of steps in mind, like how do we actually usually approach that?
Yeah. I don't know if there's like a global skeleton for this, but I'll just talk based on my experience. I think, you know, there are essential steps that we're all familiar with. And obviously, step number zero is to start with really understanding what it is that you're trying to solve. And I feel like this is actually a step that many people kind of go past pretty quickly. In many cases, I mean, I've been there, we make the mistake of assuming things that are not necessarily the case. And we kind of get past a lot of information that's missing from the table. Defining the problem doesn't really happen in one stage. So I've tried to do this where I would sit and be like, okay, you know, I'm going to define the problem and, you know, work through the data science lifecycle, collect the data and build the models and put them into production, it never actually ends up working that way. And especially when you're in a startup and there's a lot of changing dynamics, what you define today may not be what you need in another month. And being aware of that is very important. So you would start with a cycle, and I'll walk through my cycle, and then I'll add an important point at the end of it. So defining the problem, this could be, you know, with the stakeholders, so the business owners or whoever business department you're working with to make this product happen, whoever is involved in, you know, bringing this product to life. Depending on your problem, and in most cases, I assume you're going to need a domain expert. This is not something you should overlook. In my case, for example, and I didn't, in the case of the HR tech company, I came into this problem of, you know, let's do behavioral interviews and let's get AI to assess them. And the first thing that popped into my mind is, how on earth are we going to assess soft skills, right? Because as people, we can assess them quite differently. And I had no idea how to tackle this problem from even like a general sense, not from a machine learning sense. And we came to realize that actually there are experts who are specialized in you know, designing these behavioral interviews and in scoring behavioral interviews in real life. This is actually a process that happens. Humans usually score. They have a system, they have a framework, and it's very, very well defined and it's very rigorous, right? So there's a scientific framework behind it. It's very important that the domain expert is involved at that stage to define the problem properly. In parallel, I would say, not even as a second step, but in parallel to this, you need to keep in mind access to data, right? And obviously, like, depending on your situation, it may vary a lot. Do you already have access to the data? Do you not have access to the data? How long would it take you to get access to the data? This was, for me, one of the biggest challenges in the, at least in the latest endeavor that I have with the HR tech startup, because, you know, you have this kind of balance. You need to get a product out there. The product is still not there. The data is still not in, right? So where do you start? And there's a lot that you can do here. So you can try to find proxy data that might kind of like serve as an initial data set for your problem, if that's something that you can find. So something available online that's as close as possible to what you're trying to solve. You could try to somehow get data in any way possible. So for example, for me, it was trying, you know, to get people I know to kind of conduct interviews and start collecting that initial base to run experiments, right? And some POCs to see, you know, how can we get this off the ground? So defining the problem and access to data would be like the initial stage of kind of starting the whole process. Once you kind of have a good idea of what the problem is and you've understood from the domain expert what it would take to actually bring that to life. So for example, in my case, with the product that I have right now, okay, understanding that there are psychologists who conduct these interviews, you know, they have criteria, like, when I say criteria, I mean like an Excel sheet of criteria, right? This is what we look for in a candidate when we're evaluating their communication skill, let's say. So once I was able to kind of get this criteria, I was like, okay, now this is something I can work with, right? If you were to tell me score the person's communication skill, I wouldn't even know where to start. But when you tell me, you know, we need to look specifically at how the person presents certain things in the conversation or how the person speaks or how fluent they are in the conversation, this is where you can start to translate the business problem into a data science problem and have something solid that you can actually build in the data science world. And then you kind of start diving into the modeling side. So how do I tackle the problem? The most straightforward way is to kind of see, you know, what have others done in a similar place? What have they used before? What has worked? What has not worked? And from there, I'm always someone who would opt for start with the simpler solution as a starting point, POC, see how it goes, and then add complexity if needed. I have a lot of directions, especially recently, where people would kind of jump directly on, oh, let's get a GPT to, you know, take all the data and solve the problem for us. And it really, really doesn't work that way. I mean, there's a lot of benefit to the latest type of LLMs that we've seen. There's a lot of amazing things that you can do. But for example, there is no way that I could throw, you know, whatever criteria I have at GPT and be like, score this interview for me. That would be a disaster. So you really want to work with what you have, right? Make sure that you really understand the problem, see what people have done and how they've solved it, and start with the simplest possible solution that you can find to solving it and iterate from there. Once you've kind of had an initial good starting point with POCing, like the modeling stage, where you actually have a brain that functions for the functionality that you want, you want to also start thinking about the engineering side. I actually did those things at the same time. So I was thinking of the modeling and the, when I say engineering, I mean like serving of the models and what that would require. With that, I would stress even more on simplicity, because I feel like one thing, I mean, for me, this was kind of the area that I was kind of newer to, coming from a PhD, right? So what would be the best way to do it? What would be the best way to serve? What would be the best way to put things into production? And I was bombarded, like when you read online, there's like so much recommendations, best practices, so many tools. And I really felt like I don't really need, right? At least at the stage that I was, I don't really need this whole world of MLOps with all the, you know, delicate pieces and all the complexities that would come into it to do what I need to do today. Like, very critical thing for me was to block out like this noise of you need to do it this certain way and really try to have the best judgment that you can, taking into consideration your resources, the size of your company, the size of users that you're serving, right? And the reliability that you need to offer in the product that you're serving. There are certain places where mistakes are tolerable, certain places where mistakes are not. So this is kind of how I went through the flow. It's a typical flow, but the most important point that I said I'll mention at the end is the iteration. I know it's cliche, we all say that, right? But if you don't stop maybe every sprint or however you work, every month or whatever, at a certain interval, and look back at the decisions that you've made and see what has changed and what needs to be improved or what needs to be put on hold or what needs to be added now that wasn't necessary before, you will end up finding yourself in a position where, in a disastrous position, really. Because especially, again, startups, smaller, it doesn't even have to be a startup, but like a smaller organization or even an organization at large, but starting with their data initiatives, there's going to be a lot of change. If you're not conscious, if you get sucked into the work, this is something that happened to me. If you get sucked into, you know, the details of your work and you forget to kind of zoom out and reflect and see what needs to change, what needs to be moved up, etc., you will face a very challenging situation, I believe. So yeah, I mean, this is as much as I could put into like details in a roadmap or how I would tackle things.
And what you described sounds suspiciously like Chris PM, simplified version of this. You know,
really?
Yeah.
No.
Like, okay. So let me try to summarize what you said. Like, the first, the zero step is understanding what you want to solve. Like, we don't need to assume things, we need to understand. And then step number one is defining the problem, which to me sound very related to step number zero. I guess they're kind of from one, it follows the other. We understand what kind of data we have. We define the problem and then we see what kind of data is available. And if not, what kind of proxy data we can get, like how can we actually do the modeling, right? And then the next part is modeling. And here we start with the simplest solution. And then in parallel, after that, we have the deployment. Right. Did I forget anything?
No, I mean, it's the standard steps, right? It's just, for me, the trickiest part is the initial, right?
Yeah.
It's where I find most of us mess up. And I say this because I've also worked with a lot of people. And the last part, which is the iteration, which is always there in those images that we see, right, online. But we kind of, it slips by, right? And I would add for the data point, for the point about, you know, what data is available, also, what data do you need, right? Because sometimes you have data available and you might think, you know, this is what works for your problem, but you have things that are missing. And I've been over and over again, actually, this is an ongoing process for me where, you know, you collect data and then you look at it. And when you really evaluate, you find it's missing something that's critical for you, right? You need to go back, adjust the data generation processes, recollect data and see, does that really give you the data that you're looking for or not? So for example, to give you something practical, when we first started collecting interviews, we started with a set of questions. We realized the candidates are not really giving very detailed responses. We need details from them, right? So we were like, okay, maybe the questions are like too broad. So we improved the questions and we made them more detailed and more specific. The responses got a lot better. The candidates were responding for longer. So previously they had really short responses. They were not enough to kind of extract information from. Now they got to a point where they're giving longer responses, they're giving examples, et cetera. We noticed in some cases, candidates were kind of assuming that the person is watching and they were referring to the CV, et cetera. So we added guidelines that clarified you know, you're being assessed by an AI, make sure that each response is like complete and coherent. You don't refer to other responses or something offline, right? This helps. So on and so forth, right? So you collect, you see, you evaluate, you see something's missing, you adjust. This is also something that I assume would happen in any case where you're building, especially where you're building something new.
And many of these things are more related to the product work and user experience work rather than only the model, right? Like this is how you present the thing to the user. This is how it interacts with this thing. One, probably you cannot easily separate one from another.
Not really, exactly. Because how did we realize that the interviews were not sufficient? It was because of the modeling results that we came back and we're like, why, you know, why are things not going well? What's happening? We went back to the interviews and we're like, oh, okay, that makes sense because the interviews are really quite bad, right? But it's not the candidate's fault. It's never the candidate's fault, right? So you have to improve the user experience. And it's an ongoing thing. Till today, it's always about going back and changing something in the user experience that would improve how they interact with these models, right? So that you end up getting the results that you need. So they're quite intersected.
And I'm thinking about your use case. So you said that you want to understand the soft skills. And for that, people have developed frameworks. There are criteria that let you assess candidates according to different dimensions, so to say. So there is fluency, you mentioned, there's something else. And I guess what you need to do is that you would have a model that assesses one or multiple of these criteria dimensions, right? So let's say if we talk about fluency, like how can we build a model that says whether a candidate is fluent or not fluent, right? So then this is your problem, right? And then you start from this, like, okay, what do I want to solve? I want to understand that the fluency of a candidate, right? How can I do it with AI, with machine learning, right? Like what kind of data? This is how the process looks like, right? So then for each of the criteria, you would have a model, right? Something like that?
Or more. Yeah, exactly. Because the criteria are quite defined for humans, right? So when you read it as a person, it makes sense and it's quite easy to assess. But when it comes to doing it through, you know, machine learning or data science or, you know, maybe even basic text analytics, you end up having to probably use several techniques for assessing one single criteria.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, yeah, depending on what the criteria is, some of them are easier than others.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned LLMs, and you also said something along these lines that nowadays, some people think that all you need to do is just throw your problems at LLM, and then the LLM will just magically solve it, which is not the case. It would lead to a disaster when you do that, right? So in your opinion, in your experience, now all these LLMs that we have, like, does it change the process we follow when working with ML products? Or it's just one of the tools and the process still stays the same as, four years ago?
I would say the process should not change. Has it? Probably. I think people are taking shortcuts. Well, you know, whoever is following the mindset that I shared, which is like, okay, let's get a GPT to solve it or to score it or to assess it or whatever, because that would get you past all the initial stages of understanding the problem, of choosing the right technique to solve the problem, maybe even finding the right data for it, right? Especially if you're, I mean, not eloquent enough to be able to properly assess these LLMs and how they're performing at the end of the day. I mean, for me, I say GPTs because LLMs have been around for longer, but I'm talking about more, you know, the GPTs, the generation models and the kind of, you know, the hype that happened there. We still have the LLMs, right, for like BERT, for example, text classification, all that stuff. So these are still very task specific. I would say these are still tools that we can use. What they have changed is kind of the way that we can do things, right? So one application of LLMs that I really love, and I feel like there's a lot of value there, is using it as an interface to your product. You can use it as an orchestration layer. So just the way that a user will be able to interact with your application can be enhanced greatly because of this advancement that we've seen. But I wouldn't use it as a replacement, right? I have been in many scenarios where, you know, I have people tell me, you know, can we get OpenAI models to predict a certain classification value for us in a certain problem? And this is what people assume, right? They assume these models can do anything and they forget the initial capability of the model. They're not built to support such tasks. And this is kind of the challenge that I've seen. And I don't know if you've been there, or I don't know. Actually, I want to hear your opinion on this, but I've been in many situations where I kind of felt like I was looked upon like I'm outdated, right? It's like, oh, you're anti-GPT. I'm like, no, but this is not the intention of these models, right? You're setting yourself up for failure if you work with them with an incorrect assumption. I think, you know, these models have brought about a lot of opportunity, but I don't see it changing the way that things have been done, but more new opportunities actually that can be presented in how we solve problems. What's your take?
Well, it looks like if we manage to keep the process the same, it looks like we can have a first iteration way faster with these new tools, right? So for example, we can do is just, hey, like these are criteria for assessing fluency. Just tell us if the candidate is fluent or not. Well, fluency maybe is a bad example because you probably analyze audio rather than text. But yeah, let's say coherence, right? Like if the candidate is coherent or not. Like you just throw a bunch of text on this and you say, like, here are criteria how you evaluate coherence, and then what do you think, right? So probably you can arrive at the first solution rather quickly, right? And then maybe it will work, maybe it will not, but at least you will start getting some feedback.
You have a first POC. Yeah, that's also another one of the good opportunities that you could have, right? So being able to, I mean, if it's applicable for you to test things quickly and to kind of have something, because that's something I was faced with, honestly. And one thing that might come back to bite you is if you start POCing with these models and you think that they work, but they're not working. And then you realize you have to kind of take a step back and you're going into more basic techniques, right? So now instead of kind of starting with something that works, you're kind of put behind, right? You're kind of put behind on schedule. This is something that I've at least faced. In the past.
I see. Well, it's not like I have a lot of experience of using LLMs to solve business problems. As a user, I use them quite extensively. So for example, right now, I'm preparing for an exam in German, and then there is this writing part, and then they have strict criteria. And then what I do is I give ChatGPT my text, set of criteria, and say, okay, ChatGPT, what do you think? Like, how many scores will I get? And then say, oh, your text is awesome. You'll get like 15 out of 15.
Don't trust it. Yeah, I mean, because I've played around with it, honestly, with, you know, specifically like these criteria, seeing if it's able to kind of do things as needed, right? Because it depends on what you're trying to solve. If you're trying to just say the person is good, the person is bad, maybe it can do that properly, decently well. But if you're trying to distinguish between people on a scale of 0 to 100 and really kind of be very specific about the criteria and how good this person is versus to this person, you really need something that's a lot more specialized for what you're trying to build. And for me, GPTs did not do that.
So, which means for you, your life doesn't really become simpler. You still need to do all this modeling, collect all this data, right?
For this specific problem, yes. But in other areas, a lot of things have been simplified. Yeah, because like I told you, there's a lot of opportunities to, for example, enhancing the interview process, being able to make it more user-friendly, giving the candidates maybe live feedback. These are things that you can very easily do leveraging these models without having, you know, to build complex engines.
Yeah, I imagine that if I talk to a screen, right? One thing is if I just talk to the screen and it's recorded. And the other thing is if there is, okay, an avatar, it's still not a human, but something that reacts to me saying, like, maybe notes, and then
she knows. She talks to you. She encourages you. She's really nice.
Things can be built with these chatbot capabilities that are way better with LLMs than without them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's definitely a lot that's improved, a lot that can be done better, some things that can be done a lot faster, right? I didn't get that lucky with my specific use case. But yeah, I mean, even with, I'll give you another example. One thing that I assumed was, you know, we can leverage these models for data generation, right? maybe they can produce a few interviews for us. They really don't do a good job at it because it's really hard to get them to diversify and to give you enough of diversity. And it's really hard to get them to reflect a bad interview. Mm-hmm. Actually, this was one of the challenges that I had, like how it would very explicitly tell you that it's doing a bad job. And people would never really do that. So it's not, they didn't really serve the job as well as needed. So yeah, I guess, you know, it was one of those use cases that didn't see much value at this point, at least.
So I imagine that in these evaluation systems, we can have some biases because when humans evaluate other humans, we have some biases, and these biases inadvertently creep into our machine learning solutions for evaluating people. How can we mitigate these biases when we work with machine learning?
Very good question, because the bias comes up in many different areas, right? The first initial step is the human bias that can creep in, which is essentially where the data is being labeled. The interviews are being labeled, for example, in my case. So, I mean, I'm going to give specific examples here to my use case, but one, if you want, methodology that we use to kind of mitigate having a person's bias creep into the modeling process, at least, is to have many people score an interview, have several people scores on an interview, and then take an aggregate of their scores. And in this way, and by the way, this is actually how it's done in practice. So usually when companies conduct these interviews, you have several interviewers who are scoring you, and then they would combine their results to come up with the final results. So so that not one person's bias is creeping into the system, right, and kind of defining their own opinions on you. The second way is through the criteria that I mentioned. So by having very clear criteria and by trying to standardize the process across every candidate and across everyone who's scoring, you try as much as possible to navigate that people don't come up with their own definition of what communication, good communication is, right? So they've all followed very specific criteria. Did the candidate show this behavior? Yes, no, medium, high, etc., right? Did this candidate show this specific behavior? So to break it down to as small pieces as possible to mitigate these internal biases, to standardize, right, and to aggregate results across the scoring panel, essentially, whose labels are taken and fed into the models.
So imagine these criteria, these standards, they exist for a reason. And this reason is we humans have biases. So how can we remove subjectivity as much as possible?
Exactly.
Like when humans interview other humans, right? So we want to remove subjectivity there. That's why there are these criteria, right? That's why there are
standards. So you know, my teammate, who's the psychologist on the team, she explained it to me in a very nice way. She said, you know, if I tell you, team, you know, score this person on communication, and I score this person on communication, and that's the only criteria we have very different mental models of what communication means. It's not, and when we talk about bias here, I'm not talking about like negative intended bias, right? But these internal mental models that we have. But if I tell you, and, you know, we need an XYZ by communication, you know, we have a closer model of representation in our minds when we're scoring. But if I give you very specific criteria, we're as close as possible to thinking about this assessment in the same way. There's still differentiation, and that's a good thing, right? There's still differentiation because you're kind of getting an overall assessment from several people and not just one person's opinion, which is, you know, to ensure fairness and to ensure that, I don't know, there's not one specific person's opinion going into play, but we're assessing the same thing. We're looking at the same criteria. And we're very diligent about this. So there's a lot that's done. We conduct regular sessions where, for example, the panel scores together and they discuss the results and they make sure, you know, no one has trained and is scoring in a different way. We make sure we're following the criteria the same way, the rules of scoring the same way, trying to standardize it as much as possible, right? And again, there's always potentially flaws that can creep in. But for me, I always go back and I compare to the benchmark. The benchmark is you would be assessed by one person in reality if you make it to the actual interview. And you will be judged by that person's own biases, right? In an automated interview like the one that we have, and actually there's many of them out there today, it's a standardized approach. But also, at least in our case, we don't really know anything about you. We're not collecting anything about you in terms of personal information. We don't care. We're really just listening to your interview. and following that criteria. We're very careful about how we evaluate audio and video. We don't use these to assess your soft skills, by the way. We assess different aspects because according to literature, they're not reliable. So, you know, obviously trying to do things as diligently as possible to make sure, you know, you're not coming up with your own idea of what good communication is and you're following standard research that's been established in the psychology space. That's the best that you can do really to make sure that the process is as reliable as possible.
Maybe last question. I know we are a bit over time.
It's okay. It's good for my time.
Yeah. So there's a question from Batul, and it's related to what we were talking about. So communication can be quite subjective, but it's also different for different roles. The communication we expect from a data analyst can be different from communication skills we expect from a data engineer, right? So communication, like data analysts need to talk more with stakeholders, while data engineers might need mostly to talk to their managers, right? Something like that, right? So the expectations are different and the sort of communication skills are different. Does it mean that your system needs to have adjustment for different roles? Or like,
It does. Today, the way that it's handled is by the recruiter. So the recruiter is the one who essentially knows or should know the requirements for, you know, the position they're hiring for. And even though, so the system assesses you the same way, right? So in the background, the system is assessing you regardless of what your industry is, where you're going to work, etc. You have a certain communication capability that's been presented in your interview, and that's assessed. But the way that you are ranked and presented to the recruiter is based on criteria that they set. So they set a specific level or expectation of communication, let's say, depending on the role requirements. And then your score is matched with their requirements. If you are above that score, you're considered to be a good fit for the role. If you're below, you're considered to be not well fit in this specific capacity, the specific competency. We also have this interesting concept, actually, that I wasn't aware of before. But if you are above the requirement in a certain threshold, you're also considered to be overqualified. You could have an overqualification of soft skills that would make you get to a point where perhaps you might end up unsatisfied with the role and want more, right? So these are things that we measure and we kind of show, you know, where are you at the scale reference that the recruiter defines depending on the job requirements. So that's a good question, actually.
Yeah. On the candidate side, it must be quite frustrating when you get rejected with this overqualified.
We don't reject because you're overqualified. It's a concept of, what was it? It was a really interesting concept that was defined by, again, my teammate. This is her area of expertise. But she compared it. It's not like you're overqualified, like you're not a good fit. She defined it actually differently, which is, you know, you either have the capability, right? So this is what makes you like the perfect fit today, but you could also have potential, like exceeding potential. So when you're overqualified, you have the capability and you have potential. So you're a plus plus, right? You have the potential to grow. You have a potential perhaps for a higher role, maybe a different position. So all these things are monitored and reported back. Well, yeah, exactly. Even if you're underqualified in that skill, you're not rejected automatically. If you don't match on a specific portion of the criteria, then you're not the best fit, but you're not thrown out. Again, like the way that we've done the system is to be very careful that we're not making decisions. All the candidates are there. We're simply assessing. The recruiter looks at the results and they decide.
You just give them a bunch of numbers, explain these numbers, and then they think, okay, this is important for us. Maybe for this part, it's not really important. Let's just take a look at this candidate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's amazing. I was wondering, maybe there are interesting resources, books, courses, articles, YouTube videos about machine learning in HR tech. Do you know of any?
Oh, no, actually in HR tech, I struggled when I was in the space until I got my colleague on board who was the domain expert, and she taught me, you know, everything that I know today when it comes to kind of, you know, the recruitment side. But cliche, but I actually recommend your Zoom camps to everyone who tells me, you know, if I want to grow in the space, how do I do that? And I always recommend the Data Talks Club Zoom camp as kind of like an experience. I know many people kind of go like, this is kind of drifting a bit, but a lot of people talk to me about like building their profile and, you know, struggling to find their first role or their second role or whatever. And, you know, projects are always something that's encouraged. But one thing I've always kind of encouraged towards is to find as close as possible to real world projects. And one community whose project I really like is Omdina as well, where, you know, you work on actual projects with big teams and it's quite a realistic experience, I would say, as close as possible to what you could get if you're working on a team. And this way you build your portfolio as well. Communities have been a big thing for me, being part of communities like DataTalks. I'm not selling you guys. I'm actually a huge fan. But communities like DataTalks and MLOps community, very interactive, very helpful, very responsive, right? So if you're struggling, stuck on something, you know, ask. People are a lot more helpful than you would assume. Joining communities has been a big thing for me and navigating a lot of the challenges that I did. So yeah, these are things that I would recommend at the top of my head.
Yeah, thank you for your kind words about community, this community and communities in general. And yeah, thanks for staying a bit longer to answer.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I guess that's it for today. So thanks again a lot. And thanks everyone for joining us today too, for asking questions, for being active. And we see each other next week. I think next week we have 2 or 3 interviews. Yeah.
Great.
So it'll be fun. Okay.
Yeah, good luck with that.
So yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Take care and good night.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Bye.